Good afternoon. This is your host, Chef Elena Alexander, and I'm sitting with Lawrence Wilborn, my biological father, and we are going to have a discussion today about my favorite topic, food, and its impacts and its cultural backgrounds and things of that nature. Just for your FYI, as it were, my father was big in the revolutionary movement of the 60s and 70s. And is now, you know, delightfully called an older hippie. So I'm going to have him come up and we can get to going on this conversation about food and its impacts.
Yeah, peace and love, everybody. Groovy.
Wavy gravy. So, Lawrence, go ahead and give our audience your full name and a little background about where you grew up and et cetera.
Yeah, Lawrence Wilborn grew up in Chicago. Parents, two working parents. I'm the youngest of three males. The middle one died early, and so I grew up pretty much by myself. My parents were older, and I was left pretty much alone with parents who were looking forward to us, their progeny, remaining American and step just a little bit further up the ladder of
assimilation.
Yeah, of assimilation.
Okay.
My father's kind of like a really bright guy and lived his life in frustration because of his society that kept on rejecting him. So he was hoping that his sons would do a little bit more to become really mainstream Americans. The hippie movement came along in a total rejection of everything that was heading us toward World War III. If World War III breaks out, even by accident, there'll be nothing left to discuss. So this was a big thing with the hippie movement, just the natural foods movement, the women's rights movement, the environmental movement, the whole food movement was all part of this attempt to get away from the path that was leading humanity toward what we believed is extinction. We used to have the expression, don't trust anybody over 30. None of us believed that we would ever reach age 35, that it would all be over in a great big flash. World War III can take place in a single 24-hour period, and we know good and well that would be the end of the story.
So is that a product of the post-industrial age?
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. World War I was a war of human beings versus humans. World War II was a war of steel and iron and chemical production. Industrial war became the way to kill millions, hence Germany and Japan's success. It ended with the technological war of nuclear weapons. And nuclear weapons was so unusual to humans that we still haven't managed to digest what it really means.
Okay. So you went from a blue-collar background to the hippie movement and away from, it's very much into the anti-establishmentarianism that implied. How did that change your relationship with food?
Yeah, in order for basic survival, you've got problems living on planet Earth, food, shelter, clothing. You don't have those, you're going to have a problem. Most of us find that as social animals, those people who help you with food, shelter, clothing, reproduction, they tend to form bonds, familial, community, social, economic, political bonds. This creates like this whole state of mind between providers, receivers, potential providers. This is your whole mechanism of how this social animal is going to exist.
Okay.
You want to be able to control which way your society is going. In the industrial age, the opposite of control was happening.
Right. We went from farming or gardening most of our food to getting food out of a metal container from a factory.
Yeah, from a factory. And the whole system became less and less under the control of your social group, your bond. You don't pick the house. You don't pick where you're going to live. You don't pick the food you eat. You pick the food that the factories provide. Who's running this system? The system is taking on its own inertia. It's running itself, and it's running you toward World War III. How are we going to break that cycle? Are we going to argue with Heinz Food and tell them to do something? No, they're doing things on the basis of their agenda, which is like profit and power.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So anytime a corporation.
They're not going to listen to you.
Yeah, and I teach the youth. I teach at a high school, and I teach at a community center, and I teach culinary. One of the questions I frequently ask them is, "What happens when you leave options to a corporation?" Anytime the corporation is producing a food product, they are not concerned with your nutrition. They're not concerned with the many variety of things that food actually is about. What they're actually, their number one idea, their number one status quo, no matter what's going on, is to make a profit. So if this chemical that tastes like strawberries is cheaper than strawberries,
guess who? What's going to happen?
So when I ask them things like, well, what's in the food you just ate? And they can't tell me, or if they try to read the nutrition label and they can't pronounce half of what's on it, I say to them, okay, why are you accepting this product as food? Because a corporation told you it was food?
Exactly. And the corporations know that this is not just the money, but the power and the control over you. If someone controls your very survival, then you're going to have a hard time arguing with them if they want something. Think of the disaster of Enfamil and Similac. Neither one of those products can be identified by the parents who are encouraged to give them to infants. Neither of those products list hardly any ingredients
right,
that you would understand. Yet, dear mother, don't breastfeed. Give this to your child. In other words, your infant is now dependent upon a corporation more than it is dependent upon you. This kind of power, and we could talk about Monsanto for days.
Right. I don't even know if I want to broach that in this conversation.
My God. If they can control your own bloodstream before you're 2 years old, oh, yeah, I think they own you. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was surprised early on in my first pregnancy with my oldest. I started researching, okay, formula versus breastfeeding and et cetera, et cetera. And come to find out that medical communities have identified 300 components in breast milk. 250 or so of them are unidentified. They know that it's there, but they can't tell you what it is. They hadn't investigated breast milk enough that they could tell you all the parts of it. But at the same time, the corporation is developing a formula of chemicals and products to replace breast milk. So how do you do that when you don't know what's in breast milk?
Yeah.
That was confusing to me and put me on a path where I was like, no, actually I am going to breastfeed my child.
Yeah, this whole idea of I'm going to be in control of my life. I think this is a large part of the revolution against the industrial movement, that the hippie thing and that culinary can also directly see as beneficial. If someone else is controlling the water that you drink, they pretty much control you. If somebody else is controlling where your food comes from and leaves you in a position where you don't even know, where you don't know what's in this, and get you to accept this notion, oh, the corporation is taking care of you. Yes, but for their agenda, not necessarily for your agenda. And perhaps their agenda is at your expense. And no one's going to stop this except the individual. It takes the individual to walk up to a doctor and say, no, I'm not going to take that drug. Oh, please, it's for your own benefit. You don't want to be a difficult patient, do you? Because then I'll have to try to, you know, get around your resistance.
Or put a label on your file like hypochondriac. Yeah,
oh, let me put down here combative.
Okay. All right. I'm so with that. Now, even though we had a very long separation, one of the things that was considered unique about the time in early childhood spent with you was the fact that we were vegetarians. Can you tell me what prompted that decision, what type of vegetarian that we were, and whether or not you're still in that mind frame, or have you made a change since then?
Yeah, the system that I found most useful is called macrobiotics. It's based on the teachings of Nyoichi Sakurazawa. I may not pronounce his name correctly. He has an American name, George Osawa. This can be looked up, the George Osawa Institute.
Okay.
He's a scientist. He did research into what is food? Why do we need to eat in the first place? Okay, what are we getting from this? His system was based on the principles of Zen Buddhism and of Taoism. He says, listen, if you follow a certain religious philosophy, should that not also be directly applicable to your diet?
Many religions have dietary restrictions.
Yes, this is more than just a restriction.
Okay.
This is actual chemical analysis of all the different foods. And relating that to an actual chemical analysis of the human body. And what he found was a 5-to-1 ratio.
What does that mean?
Between, there's 5 parts of potassium to you, to every 1 part of sodium in you. So ideally, when you're healthy, your system is 5-to-1 in a potassium sodium relationship.
So like on a blood test, he could
Muscle tissue.
Okay, so it can easily be found if you're imbalanced.
Yes.
Okay.
And he says a healthy person has this 5-to-1 relationship. He equated that with the yin-yang theory. Sodium has certain tendencies. Potassium seems to have the complementary opposite tendencies. He made that his yin-yang.
Okay.
So what he did then, recognizing 5-to-1 as being the ideal, he looked for foods that would have 5-to-1. He has listed a whole range of ordinary dietary ingredients that people, you know, normally consume around the world, and analyze them for their 5-to-1 sodium-potassium relationship, and then produced a scale showing this is the most potassium level, this is the least. This is the most sodium level, this is the least. And he's got this really cool list that goes da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And he found the ideal food. He found a food that is already in a 5-to-1 relationship, brown rice. And so macrobiotics was not like most, like many dietary systems, a list of don'ts.
Right. Don't eat pork. Yeah, don't eat this.
Avoid this because of that.
Don't mix dairy and meat.
Okay. Most of those are don'ts. His is do eat this because this, it makes you do the least amount of work to digest it.
Okay.
To get it back to 5-to-1. It's already 5-to-1. And it also works out that this is widely used food product, brown rice, and for some reason it seems to be successful, and the success of it was now chemically quantifiable, not just culturally
or socially.
This is
the most accepted.
We're not going to talk history, we're going to see which one of these foods is probably most useful for your 5-to-1 relationship. So if you vary away from the 5-to-1 in your foods, he says, by yin yang, you'll automatically be attracted to the other end of the spectrum.
So if, like, you have a craving for said item, perhaps that's about you being in balance?
Yes. And so he's using that as a self-diagnostic and as a, a prescriptive kind of thing. If you eat, and it turns out the most sodium rich are the lean red meats. And he says that the most potassium rich are the extreme fruits, the pineapple, the tropical fruits.
Okay. With a lot of acid.
Yeah, that goes as acid-base kind of relationship. Okay. He says, if you eat on this end of the scale, you will be attracted to that end of the scale. You will suddenly have a craving for it. You'll have a bodily need for it. Your mind may pick this up as, gee, I would really like to have a banana right now. He says that's not just psychological. There says that there's actually a chemical thing going on that brings you into this thing where you need that balance. People in the tropics, they have the strongest desire for salt. People who can get banana by just sticking your arm out the window, they live their lives with cravings for salt. Actually, it's actually hard to get salt in most tropical
locations. Okay.
Yeah. It turns out that, unfortunately for blacks, when we moved away from the tropical environment, the desire for salt was so strong still in us that we overeat salt.
I also heard, and I don't know, you know, how verifiable it is, but a lot of the hypertensive in the African American, I read an article that a lot of that had to do with Middle Passage, that when the transportation of slaves through ships in the ocean happened, those individuals that held on to sodium within their blood the least were the first to get sick. And that once they got sick, they were either disposed of or died before they got here. So a large amount of the population generations later that are here, that families went through Middle Passage, there's a lot of hypertension because they were more suited for digestion and retention of salt in their bloodstream than other groups.
That's probably chemically provable instead of just anecdotal. It's probably chemically provable. Or at least there should be some trace, a way to detect this in actual analysis.
And I think, and I'm, those of you in the medical community that know better than I, but I also heard that was a connection with items like sickle cell. That mutation of the blood cell actually benefited those who had it versus those who didn't, because they didn't get things like malaria.
Very much the case. As a matter of fact, I was reading something about sickle cell research. It turns out that it is a defense against malaria. And the only other people who are really suffering this are Italians. And it turns out that the Italians are related to Africans because the Nile River is directly north of Italy. And that the reason why, I don't know for sure about this, but they say that the reason why Italians have more body hair is a protection against malaria.
Harder for the mosquito to bite.
Harder for the mosquito to hit you without you getting a signal and a warning.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So all of your learning about balance, chi, martial arts, all of those things fed into you becoming a vegetarian?
Yes. Well, there was, of course, the politics of meat. I wrote a pretty good undergraduate paper on what is vegetarian, what is vegetarianism. And it turns out that 83% of the people who are vegetarians, they are doing that to protect themselves, not from bodily contamination, but they're doing something for their souls. They're trying to protect their souls from contamination. And what is the contamination? Well, it turns out that people who are associated with blood, they tend to have a different way of looking at the world. Those countries that call themselves fatherland are 80% more likely to engage in aggressive war than those countries that call themselves motherland.
Interesting, because it's Mother Russia.
Yeah, it's Mother Russia.
But it's Father Germany.
Oh, absolutely, we are the fatherland.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Isaac Bashevis Singer. I don't know if you know him. He's an Israeli novelist. Okay. Nobel Prize.
Okay.
He says there is only one step between somebody who draws blood for food, who will draw blood for war. It's a really small step. Because look, if you take a bunch of kids and you want them to be soldiers, that's difficult. It is hard for a person to kill another person. It's easier if they're red blood eating, if they used to eat raw red meat with the blood dripping out of the hamburger.
Okay. I have, and it's just my little assessment, I have met all types of people with different diets, and that's what a chef does. And I've noticed when it comes to the vegan, vegetarian aspect of eaters, that there always seem to be two distinct groups to me. One was the political group. I will not eat because of animal cruelty. I will not participate in this system because of the harm to other life. Then there also seems to be the dietary vegetarians who, I want to do this for increased health. I want to do this for a more peaceful society. That always seems to be the mark for me. And frequently I would ask or pry a little bit and say, and we're doing this, why?
Yes, why? That was the biggest part of the hippie movement. We could ask our society why, and they could not or would not answer us. And I think that's the turning point, is when an individual then asks herself, himself, why am I doing certain things? Okay, that's an interesting pursuit on vegans and vegetarians. There, as it turns out, there's two types of vegetarians: those who are in favor of something,
and those who are
against. Who are against something.
Okay.
And it's really important that somebody claiming to be a vegetarian makes up their mind about what that is. Why are you doing this? Because you want something, or you want to avoid something? Wanting something, as far as I'm concerned, is much more positive than simply abjuring, abhorring. Oh, I don't do that. I shun something. You know, I'm shunning something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, shunning something only leaves you with accidentally being in the vegetarian camp.
Okay.
It doesn't say that you want to be a vegetarian. It just says that you refuse to be something.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's only a half a decision as far as I'm concerned. If you're doing something, you should know why you are going that way. Oh, I'm only going that way because I don't want to go some other way. Well, that's kind of a half of an answer. We need the other half of the answer.
Okay. Yeah, I've met quite a few. It was like, I am a vegetarian as to protest the meat marketing.
Okay. So that means you're against that.
Right. You know, they would say, well, you know, have you ever seen a slaughterhouse?
Oh, Lordy.
And my answer would be yes.
Oh, God.
You know, and that was it. I saw such and such, and I saw how they slaughtered cows, and I never touched another one.
Yes. There was an independent documentary film called Meat. I don't know if we can still get it. But it's absolutely, it goes to the feedlots and it goes to the slaughterhouses. And most people do not know where their meat is coming from and don't want to know. I guarantee most people who eat steak, if you took them to a cow and said, here, push this button and kill that cow, that one, no, not a cow, this cow, that cow will look you in the eye. She knows what you're planning to do, and I'll guarantee you will hesitate. It's a beautiful animal. Do you love dogs? Yes. Well, would you
eat
your dog? I'm sorry. Would you chop your dog's arm off? for a hamburger. No, of course not. I love my dog. And think of the pain. Okay, this is a cow. She's beautiful. She's comfortable. She's a vegetarian. She's there. And she's staring you in the face.
Well, she's a vegetarian only if she's not in a farm that is mass producing.
There you go.
That's one of the things that bugs me.
Yes.
So you end up with these factory farms, not a farm, but a factory farm. There's a big difference. The scale is much greater.
Well, we've heard of mad cow disease.
And you end up with something like that because they're feeding or forcing these animals to eat what they're not accustomed to eating on the premise that this will make their muscles bigger and more marbled with fat and therefore more desirable on the plate.
Yeah, they think that mad cow relates to prions getting into the cow. And these only could have happened as a result of cows being fed beef byproducts into their diet. Well, what's happening is that cows that were condemned, that were not fit for human consumption, were ground up and put back into cow feed.
Yeah.
And so that the prions that I think most cannibals get were forced on the cows, and that they ended up with this
dysfunction.
I can't remember the exact name of mad cow.
Yeah.
But
That's how it was colloquially.
Yeah.
You know, subscribed.
Oh, a spongiform encephalitis, something bovine spongiform encephalitis.
Encephalitis meaning water on the brain.
Yeah, water on. You got some kind of brain problem, but then at some point, that bovine encephalitis managed to strike and hit human beings. And I think it was only for certain human beings that were vulnerable to it.
Yeah, the food industry, on my end of it, does a lot to protect the most vulnerable consumer that would eat with us. Whenever we're discussing food safety and sanitation, it's not so much that you shouldn't do this or you shouldn't do that, but it's about the reduction of the bacterial count. Because what if the 80-year-old grandma comes to the restaurant? She's got a weakened immune system. She's got a underlying medical problem, and the bacteria balance is slightly high. Wouldn't bother anybody else, but then here she's hit with this disease or food poisoning or what have you, because she doesn't have enough immunity to ward off whatever you're doing. So we always look at the least common denominator to control that bacteria growth, because no matter what you're doing, food that we consume naturally, they're all designed to rot. If it's a peach, when do we want the peach? When the peach has the most sugar in the flesh. That's right before it starts to rot, because that's its job. You know, the tree's putting out this seed bearer, and it's supposed to roll away from the tree far enough to become another tree. So it's designed to rot. So when we have to deal with preservation and bacterial count and things like that, not the fun stuff of, oh, it's so pretty and look at it, it's so lovely and delicate and the flavors are great. No, a lot of what we do is about presenting it safely.
Yeah. That's interesting. The notion of rot, it turns out that apparently all life is supposed to rot. All life comes in with the telomerase attached to it. It turns out that
everything has a shelf life.
Scheduled to die. You're scheduled to die. Apparently, evolution won't work unless the individual dies. So what happens is you have this system where you provide evolution with some kind of service. Mm-hmm. That is to say, you go out and engage in natural selection and you're challenged by your environment to see whether or not you have certain traits that are give you a slight reproductive advantage. And then after you serve your evolutionary function, hurry up and get out the way. You know, hurry up and get away because we need the space. You know, we need this. Your apartment, you know, you need to come on. We can put it back on the market so somebody else can have it. We need somebody who's about 19, who's going to buy your house, who's going to reproduce, and then they have to hurry up and die. Oh, come on, have a car accident or something so that you'll get out the way. Otherwise, evolution would be fundamentally slowed down. If you live to be 250 years old, you still got to have food and an apartment, and you're not evolving anymore. We need to get on to the next generation, and the only way that the next generation get here is the present one got to get out the way.
Okay. With that in mind, are you still a vegetarian?
I can't say that because the definition of that term has changed to the point where there's a certain amount of strictness and political correctness involved with it. So when you say, yes, I am a vegetarian, then it's sort of like claiming membership in a club. And then the other vegetarians, they want to vet you to see whether or not it's really true. And it's very social stratification. And you're going to prove to your neighbors that you are some sort of higher person or something. I know in India, 84% of the population is vegetarian.
Yeah,
but there's like six or seven different kinds. And so there's a competition between you're a vegetarian for what reason. And so, you know, it's a very complicated thing. So I don't use that label anymore. I claim myself macrobiotic.
Okay. In your knowledge, or if you have any knowledge to the fact that I try to teach that food is a type of medicine, but that seems to be counterculture to the American idea of what is food. Food for a great many, you know, especially the kids, I say, why are you eating that? That is not food or not the best thing for you. The answer inevitably is, oh, but it's good. That's the best thing I could taste, you know, things like that. And I go, but food is not just pleasure. Food is actually medicine and should actually hopefully be the first thing you change when you encounter disease. You say, okay, my blood pressure is high. I need to stop eating potato chips or whatever else is impacting that. When do you think that kind of changed, considering that you were born in the 50s? Before I got here, and it kind of seemed to have already been really established when I was a kid.
Yeah, turns out that vegetarianism is a very old American tradition, but so very fringe. So you're a health food nut,
yes.
It was called.
Yes.
And then there were these religious outliers who, you know, extremely strict and very unusual. And America has religious freedom. You can do that. But such groups could not hardly attract new members. You almost had to, your parents had to be in it. And the kids of those fringe elements, they mostly wanted to get away and stop
doing that. In a similar.
Yes, they wanted to get out of there. So it turns out that the hippie thing was, again, we have to examine everything. Otherwise, we are going to cease to exist. So what do we do politically, socially, culturally, religiously? All of that has to be reexamined, taken apart. Everything has to be questioned. And we started with the presumption, well, since we won World War II by killing everybody, let's start by just saying we're not going to do that anymore.
And that didn't work.
We've been in conflicts.
We've been in conflicts ever since.
It says the governments against whom we argued at the end of the Vietnam War, around 76, when we lost and got kicked out.
For the first time, lost a war.
Yes, got kicked. No, you got kicked out of Vietnam. We finally convinced people in government that a reexamination is in order. Okay. And strangely enough, the military industrial warmongers, their analysis was that you can't win a war unless the public is behind you. And so what you got to do is not assume that they're behind you, which is what they did. You have to get this large public relations mechanism going before the first shot is fired.
Okay.
So
are you not a patriot?
Right. We're going to figure out some theme to get this thing going in the public's mind before we send the troops. It used to never be that way.
Okay. Do you think that the idea of being a vegetarian or eating a microbiotic diet or eating a religious-based kosher or halal diet as prescribed by your elders of the church, is that a direct rebuffing of the American idea? Because it seems like it's such a foreign concept, although we've been knowing about these things forever and ever. Before the Mayflower, we knew what dietary restrictions were, but yet and still our young people just want McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken, and they are less likely, in my opinion, from what I've seen in my students, less likely to question why or what they eat versus some of the older people that were involved in some revolutionary type of activity.
Yeah, I think the public relations campaign done by the toy industry, done by the advertising people, Madison Avenue, was extremely successful once they really marshaled them into many aspects of American life. It used to be presumed that a Boy Scout would want to be a Marine. That was the way it worked. And that a Marine doesn't question. And that makes him an American. This makes you a patriotic person.
I've seen that in the Catholic Church, where they really don't want you to question. They only want you to accept. I tell you this.
And that makes you a good person.
And makes you a good Catholic.
Yes.
And you ask questions, well, why does the priest carry the smoker? You see this guy waving his...
Yes, why is he waving that censer around you?
And then the priest that's going to preach is behind him. What does that mean?
Why does that mean that? What does that mean?
Don't worry about that.
No, don't worry about that. And you... The answer sometimes in Catholicism was divine mystery. You're not supposed to challenge, because that's like challenging God. That's like saying, hey, God, why did you do that? And for some reason in their system, you're never supposed to say that to God.
Never. Well, if you were a Protestant, your whole basis, besides, the same Bible, was why?
Yeah, why? Why are we doing this? Why is the Pope infallible? Why is he infallible?
When does the bread and wine turn into the body and blood?
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Transubstantiation. I asked them directly about that divine mystery. It says, okay, see, that's why women can't be priests.
We asked too many questions.
What? No, because a woman cannot transubstantiate. Oh, and I said, what?
Why?
What do you mean? Oh, you wouldn't understand. It's here. And their books were written in Latin, so they would throw a book at you and say, here, you read this. And they knew you couldn't read Latin, and so they had to. Yeah. So that was part of Protestantism, is to produce a Bible in the vulgar language. It's called Vulgate. Yeah. You see, I heard this excuse. The reason why it's always Latin, it's because that's the one language that the devil can't speak. And in this way, we can guarantee that the devil will never be a priest and the devil can never be a pope because he can't speak Latin. And I says, well, that would be a pretty good guarantee were it in fact true.
Oh, my God. Okay, so let's get off religion, because that's that will spin us off into conversations way away from food.
Yeah.
They eat. I mean, yes, they do. They do. They have their rich
eating
history.
They don't eat meat on Friday.
But that was political.
Yeah, that turned out.
And a lot of people don't know that. I actually went and did some study on that.
Yeah.
Why do you abstain from meat on Fridays during Lent?
Ah.
Well, it goes back to Constantinople.
Oh.
The Pope then was petitioned by all of the fishermen that time of year in Italy. they would have an abundance of fish and not a whole lot of purchasing. So things would we're restricting this. We're during Lent. We're going to be fasting. We're going to be doing all these different things to prove ourselves worthy of Easter. Okay, so they weren't eating much of anything. In fact, a lot of them were doing a strict religious fast in which they did not eat while the sun was up. So, no, the fisherman said, Pope, you got to help us out here. We're just we're throwing away food. We're losing business. So that was, okay, on Friday you eat fish. So at least one day they knew they were going to have high sales.
Gonna get some demand around
until here. Everything went back to normal outside of the fast.
Yeah, I don't understand. I don't understand how Christopher could be a saint and then later on he ain't no saint.
Oh well,
so yeah, you could go up there,
right?
And ask him
right. There are hundreds of.
I don't understand how that happened.
There's hundreds of saints that were a saint that aren't anymore. Lexicon of what an individual saint did versus another saint was confusing to me.
Yeah, very confusing.
And it goes on and on and on from there.
Well, not to pick on the Catholics, there are plenty of strange things in other religions, and all these religions have an impact on your culture, and all these cultures have an impact on your diet and your culinary choices being made today, I think are over too much influenced by industry. The industry now has something called a combination of pharmaceutical and nutrition. Nutraceuticals, I think that's
nutraceutical.
Where they want to blend these two worlds into one.
You see it predominantly if you watch any kind of daytime television. One of the big advertisers in our market in Chicago is the Cancer Centers of America, I think that's
yes.
it. And their biggest selling point is, A, we can give you a second opinion on your cancer, and we can give you alternative treatments along with the standard regimen of chemo and radiation. And they, you know, tout whole food and naturopathic solutions while you're getting your radiation so that your body is healthier to withstand the regimen
of this.
Fighting this cancer.
Yes.
And that always seemed to me, really, so you're going to take Western medicine and Eastern medicine to bring about a more positive result. And it always seemed like a little, I don't know how to really feel about it, actually.
Yeah, it's difficult.
Is it a trend? Is it a fad?
Right. We don't know, because you try to speak with the people in the medical field. And there's so many different opinions that I'm unclear about getting a picture of the true thrust of what it is that they're trying to do. There was a time when a doctor felt that he had failed his profession and his patient when he did not effect a cure. Without cure, you feel like something is still missing.
We haven't been centered on cure since polio.
Yeah. So now that whole notion of I'm not going to cure you, I'm going to maintain you, seems to have bled over into so many other aspects of our society. And we're worried about
that. So we eat cheap foods because it's filling, not because it's good for you.
Right.
We have medicines that will put you on for the rest of your life. Versus if we do this, this, and this.
Then you're no longer diabetic. There you go, for example. We can cure your diabetes if we do this. But so let's not even think in those terms now. Let's think in terms of maintaining a diabetic for the rest of their life. Let's thinking of cancer in remission, not cancer gone.
Right, right.
Let's think of if you were ever an alcoholic, they have that same idea. You're an alcoholic forever.
Or if you're a heroin addict, they'll put you on methadone for the rest of your life.
Yes, for the rest of your life.
It's a substitute for what my body's craving. It's not a solution to the problem.
It's not a solution. It's a maintenance.
Okay. So with that in mind, trend, fad, medicine, food as medicine, et cetera, that leads me into questions about the organic food movement.
Yeah.
It seems to be something that was birthed out of the hippie movement and has had a rebirth in recent years and become extremely popular with entire chains of grocery stores like Whole Foods, and you know, touting this organic food, the natural stuff, no mm-hmm. pesticides, nor hormones, et cetera, et cetera. And at the same time, a much heftier price for similar items.
Mm-hmm.
Is this sustainable?
In that it's trendy, it is sustainable. The Samsung Corporation wants to know what's the next big thing. Okay, organic used to mean something when the hippies had that word, but now the courts have that word, and now the lawyers have that word.
Oh yeah, because you have to qualify your product.
Yeah, and but then Your Honor,
you just can't.
My corn comes from a cornfield. It doesn't get it. So when you say organic, if
it's beaver sweat, non-GMO,
right? I mean, yeah. So the definition of that term is now a legal term rather than a food term. It has nothing to do with the food. I hate to tell you, there's this a label on a lot of foods called USDA organic.
Yeah.
That's a total ripoff. USDA organic is a company. It's a publishing company. Oh, dear.
Hmm.
And if you want to use their label, all you have to do is pay the money.
You don't have to qualify the food. They don't send it in for testing.
You can send it in for testing if you want to. But essentially, you can't use that label on your product unless you are a subscriber to their service.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The latest one, it's very expensive,
by the way.
I bet. The latest labeling trend that I've seen, and unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know which, I have been a part of it due to having an underlying medical condition, is gluten-free.
Uh-huh.
Okay. That label, I don't know how provable it is. However, I'm seeing it now that it's a more popular thing to eat gluten-free. I'm seeing it on things like ice cream and corn oil. Why do you need to put gluten-free on my bottle of water? Excuse me, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
but everybody has a product out there that comes under the term of it doesn't have gluten. We'll stick a label on it and change the design on its standard label. Mm. Hey, we're gluten-free. Yeah, you should be gluten-free. You're a corn tortilla.
Yeah.
Like, explain to me, how does that happen? What does that mean?
Yeah, that reveals the nature of the marketing people. They know that if they sell you bottled water, they can sell more of it if it says gluten-free bottled water. It's
illogical.
Yeah, it makes no sense. A bottled water never had gluten in it. Yes, but ours is gluten-free.
Right.
Oh, so then that means you can charge 20% more.
Or put on it zero calories.
Oh, zero calories in our bottled water.
It's water.
Yeah. Okay, so that shows you that there's a trendy thing. There's a marketing, there's an advertising world that's having this impact. Like you mentioned, organic foods fundamentally cost more for the same products. Okay, people expect that their special food should cost more. It's the same reason why this pair of shoes by Manolo Blahnik costs more than these by Akira shoes.
Okay.
They're all manufactured in a sweatshop in some place in Indonesia or something. But here's the label that says, oh, this must be the really good one. You can't charge the same. If you're going to have special label, you have to then charge more. Otherwise, the customer will doubt the credibility.
Yeah. The psychology of purchase is interesting.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like if you talk to quote unquote food experts, and as a chef, sometimes I'm considered one of those people, they can tell you when is it important to buy organic or versus non-organic. And if you're buying a product, say an orange, that has an outer peel, that the peel gets discarded, all the pesticides that have possibly ever been sprayed on it are on top of the peel.
Yeah.
You throw it away, the orange inside, non-organic versus organic is exactly the same.
Yeah.
So I tell people things that you may want to look for the organic seal are tomatoes and things, cucumbers that you might eat the peel in your salad, lettuce, things like that, that you cannot cook and you cannot wash efficiently. So you can't get the pesticides off of it. Yeah. But at the same time, if you're buying organic nuts, all nuts come in a shell except for maybe one or two, and the shell is discarded. So what harm are you doing by buying this product that's non-organic, but spending four times the price?
Yeah, there's a couple of things going on there. One, you want to send a message to food producers that you object and that you are willing to pay a higher price. That's a political
preferred
product. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's one thing. Number two, the constant use of chemicals actually is changing all of our basic foodstuffs. You mentioned yourself that you have a gene bank where the original corn and the original potato, original wheat are kept.
Yeah.
In
there's a seed
vacuum.
Bank.
Yeah. That's a license to
and
keep
I believe
the chemicals
that's
off
in
of it.
Iceland that they have this food bank.
Yeah.
Because
they know
they
if this gene stock gets disappears, we're gone.
Or if we have a plague.
Yeah.
You know, we could easily run into another great potato famine,
we sure
like the Irish did, and millions of people died because their primary food source just disappeared for a couple of years.
This could happen to us.
So they have this food bank
in case
somebody accidentally drops the bomb and all the tomato seeds that are currently available have now been irradiated.
Yes, and there's this thing like Monsanto again and these food experimenters. There have been several disasters. One of the chemicals that is banned now is called Roundup. And as it turns out,
Roundup
changes
everywhere.
The genes in everything. And they're looking to see Roundup in human beings. They're starting to find it in the umbilical cord.
Really?
Yeah, they're starting to find Roundup in people's umbilical cord. And some of the plants are so addicted to Roundup that if they don't get their Roundup within a two-week window, they die. We can't possibly talk about a stronger addiction than if you don't get your fix, you drop dead.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah. They have these contaminated corns that are the intellectual property of certain corporations.
Mm-hmm.
They have interbred with non-laboratory corn.
Sure.
And the farmers whose fields were polluted are being sued successfully by those companies for infringement of their intellectual property.
That is impossible to contain. Once there is a live plant in a field, the bees come, the birds come,
it spreads.
I mean, it's always going to do. What scares me on the food experimental side of things is companies who have actually injected animal DNA into certain plants.
Yes.
There were tomatoes that were injected with a part of a fish scale.
Yes.
And they lasted longer. They had a brighter color, et cetera, et cetera. But nobody knows what you're doing to the consumer that eats that product.
Yes.
You don't know that is could be a carcinogen,
yes.
Could be something that makes you grow a third eye in the middle of your forehead.
Yes.
We have no idea. All they were concerned with is injecting these tomatoes with that.
Yes.
Actually gave them a longer shelf life and a better appearance.
Yes. When my father was in Arkansas, they had this thing called capon chicken. As it turns out, there's a chemical that you use to effeminize roosters.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you stop their development of testosterone
or whatever.
Yeah, their equivalent.
I don't know what that does, how it worked. But my father was saying way back then, if you put that in the food, it'll get into the humans. And he blamed homosexuality.
I've heard.
Oh, don't stop it. You're being ridiculous.
Right. I've heard of the one that I hear most frequently now is the productivity of the female contraceptive pill, that frequently a lot of the things that we ingest as medicine or food supplement, like you take a vitamin,
yeah.
A lot of times those vitamins are so hard, you're really not digesting it properly, and most of it ends up in the sewer. So They have studied the amount of estrogen in the sewers and in the rivers, lakes, and streams, and have said that doing this is feminizing the fish. So then you eat the fish, and then you have these young boys. There's more prevalence in gynecomastia in young boys, the development of breast tissue. So that you get a population of prepubescent boys that end up with breast tissue, and some of them had to have gone as far because it had been such a large amount of breast tissue that they actually had to have breast reduction surgery so that they look like the other boys.
Now, is androgyny an ideal that the American society
not wants? They don't even we haven't gotten to the point where they can accept homosexuality, let alone the further step of androgyny of one sex.
We're going to have like a new gender, which is like an amalgam gender,
or not a even, general, or a gender neutral state.
I mean, is that what we really want for ourselves? Okay, so that's
religions will tell you
thing.
No,
right? So that goes back to the hippie thing. You have to make up your own mind. I'm not going to be experimented on. I'm not going to be a part of an economy. I'm not going to be part of a war machine if I choose to opt out. Okay, the first step in opting out, what did you eat this morning? Okay, if somebody else controls that, then you're still in. So the hippies, what do you got to do?
Quakers making your breakfast.
You got to get your own land and you got to get your own water. Once you start there, then other things will start to follow. Free your mind, the rest will follow.
Right. But aren't those very simple, basic understanding of how the world works that we no longer do? Like the average American could not plant a garden and have it be 80-90% successful because they don't know what they're doing.
That's intentional. That's intentional by the industrial people. And so we had a publication called Mother Jones.
Okay.
Yeah. And what we did is we taught you, no, this is what a horse is. This is what oats are. This is what a corn is. Oh, by the way, there's a thing called a fence. You'll need one. Oh, this is a weed. You probably don't want one of these. This is what you do. This is a chicken.
Why do I feel like, is that
where the egg come from?
But why do I feel like that it's been dumbed down to like I'm reading a golden book at that point.
Yeah, you're reading a golden book.
Jack and Jill went up the hill.
Right. You see, water rolled downhill. You didn't know that, did you? See, so when that guy sold you that piece of land, you didn't know that in the springtime this floods. Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, yeah. Mother Jones says, see, when you see a piece of land, you're supposed to be able to tell how many mosquitoes are going to grow in that land and how many, you know, what's the acid content of that land by looking at what's growing in there now. Don't call the Farm Bureau. He works for the corporation. Don't call the United States Department of Agriculture. They are in the business of controlling you. A cool thing would be is if you could get on this show, this is a suggestion, get on it, two farmers, an industrial farmer and a revolutionary farmer.
Okay.
Yeah. Right here in Illinois, there's a guy in Wabena, Illinois. He makes Phil's eggs. You've seen them. Phil is right driving distance from here. I don't know whether his kids are carrying on the business, but Phil used to be the most interesting guy you could ever want to talk to. He is a chicken farmer. He has chickens, and they are his friends. And Phil was one of the coolest guys. He says, in the dairy industry, they're using tons, literally tons of Bayer products, of Merck pharmaceutical products, per ton of food.
Antibiotics.
Antibiotics were a must with these people because
they got too many animals in one space.
Yes, and their chickens were too weak and their immune systems were all compromised, so that the chicken that they're producing now and the eggs that they're producing now are totally dependent upon the industrial machine now.
Okay. I had, and you know, I used to go every summer down to the south to see the great grandmother and the great grand aunt and extended family members all of, not all, but most of which had an acre or two or more and actually had chickens in the yard and actually had corn in the backyard and things like that. So I do know the relationship between farmer and chicken. Mm. It is apparent. I could walk in the yard and the chicken's going to act one way that I'm standing there. But my great aunt would go out there and they'd walk right up to her.
Yeah.
Had no fear of them, you know, of her reaching down and snapping their necks. Yeah. Even though she would.
Even though she would.
But they saw her. Oh, she's coming to feed us.
Yeah.
And they would run right to her.
Yeah.
I walk out in the yard. They run right away.
City folk coming. City folk.
So, yeah, I can understand that. But, you know, when you have food that's antibiotic riddled, a lot of people kind of joke about the fact that, well, the African-American average black kid in Chicago eats a ton of chicken because it's cheaper than beef or pork. And when we would kind of look at, like, the next generation coming up, we always notice, like, man, when I was in fifth grade, little girls look like little girls. Now you're seeing fifth, seventh, eighth graders look like they're 20 and 30. They're fully developed. You can tell that their puberty, they've already crossed over from child to prepubescent or pubescent.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people point to, well, they'll say on the accidental, I was dating a girl. She told me she was 18 and I found out she was 14.
Oh, dear.
Well,
I didn't know.
She looked grown. I didn't check her birth certificate, but that's what she told me.
What am I supposed to do, Your Honor?
So the joke ends up, well, not really a joke, but we always say, yeah, it's that chicken. Yeah, eating all them chickens, you got all them hormones. Nah. And now we have an accelerated pubescence. I don't know if it's founded or unfounded, but people do point to things like that. Little girls don't look like little girls anymore. Not for very long, anyway.
Not for very long. So are we in control of this? Is nature in control of this? Or are the corporations in control of it? Well, as far as the hippies were concerned, let us start by getting control of our own lives. And that means three times a day, I'm going to decide. Heinz, Monsanto, Frito-Lay is not going to decide. Not IO Beef Packers. I'm going to decide what this is going to be.
You mean you didn't go down to Moon Oink?
Get these cheaper.
Okay. So, let me ask you this. Since we do see an organic movement in commercial grocery stores, there's no other way to look at it. It's not a co-op down the street that put together, you know, some offerings and it's limited. No, we're talking major corporation. Whole Food has God knows how many outlets now.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of customers that say, I only eat meat out of Whole Foods. I only do this and I only do that. Is this the wave of the future? Is this in line with that movement of controlling your own destiny and the hippie movement of divesting from governmental infringement? Or are we talking just another aspect of making a chef into a celebrity or a housewife into a pseudo celebrity? We've got all this. You're not on television anymore to educate. You're in it to promote yourself as an expert. Mm-hmm. Julia Child never had a show where she was trying to be famous. Mm-mm. Julia Child said, there is a better way to eat. Let me demonstrate.
Yeah, this is a marketing thing, and it's hard to understand for me exactly why marketers are successful. They say they test their stuff against rhesus monkeys, and so that there's certain tricks that they're doing to your brain cells to make you go that way. But I've noticed in marketing, we're moving away from something called mass marketing to target marketing. And there may be, and this may be part of that trend, where we want lifestyle. And so a person defines their lifestyle in certain terms. And now the corporations are figuring out a way to target exactly what that person means. The reason why you wear spandex is because you want to make a statement to other trendy persons that mm-hmm. year. There was a time when everybody had to drink Perrier. That was it. And if you were in the club, you drank Perrier. Now, you didn't drink Poland water. You didn't drink, no. Everybody knew that this label means that you're in the club. Now, see what happens, the labels keep changing. And so the marketers, they have to keep finding a way to tweak the machine.
Sure.
To make you think that you're in the club.
I see it all the time. Like, especially with food. Food trends tend to be very short.
Yeah.
And the only people who profit from a food trend are those who got in at the beginning.
Yes. When the curve is going that way.
Right. Cupcake fad.
Oh, yeah. Cupcake shops.
Right. You had outlets that only offered cupcakes.
That's it.
This became a fad.
That was a joke on Seinfeld at
yes,
one point.
There
muffin
were
tops.
Muffin tops. You had had lines around the block
yes.
to get into the cupcake shop.
Yeah, yeah.
Now.
Oh, Mrs. Fields.
Mrs. Fields cookie stores. I used to work for Mrs. Fields and as a pastry chef. And when I saw the cupcake trend coming, by the time the trend hit the news,
yeah.
it was already too late to get in.
The curve was going the other way.
And now a lot of them have imploded.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not exploded into, you know, 50,000 outlets across the nation. No, a lot of them have imploded because a bakery should have more to offer me than 5 flavors of cupcake.
Yeah.
Or 25. Mm. When the average shopper actually takes a special trip to go to a bakery, which is unusual now. Most of them want to go to the grocery store and peek in at the bakery department.
Mm-hmm.
Convenience versus quality. So for them to stop what they're doing and go to a bakery for something special, they want a wide variety of offerings. It's no longer about mass-produced key lime pie
exactly.
flavored cupcake, the flavor of today.
Mm-hmm.
It's, no, I'm here. I should be able to look at 17 types of breads and rolls and a few cakes and this and that.
You should be able to smell it.
Right. Oh, smell is huge.
Oh, huge.
The whole influence of smell is ridiculous. Mrs. Fields cookies.
Ooh.
Okay. I ran Mrs. Fields cookies all over the loop and at O'Hare Airport.
Oh.
The fastest way at O'Hare to up my sales, if we found a day was kind of slag, kind of low key. Two things that was always the best indicator of sales. One, if it was raining, that means that flights are being delayed.
Aha. See, that's
weather.
Clever.
If the weather was getting bad, I knew my sales were going to be high. On days where it was a clear blue sky and things were going around, I would do a couple of different tricks. One of which was take cinnamon sugar, put it on a sheet, put it in the oven. We had convection ovens with the fan in there. Start to let it burn and caramelize and then open the door and waft this smell across the... And everybody's head would turn. Ooh, what's that?
They must be like Krispy Kreme. They turn the sign on and it says hot.
Right. So there was that. Or if it was a weather day. And on occasion, when I really, you know, felt like marketing, it was a bad trick. But if I would see kids 12 years old and younger, we had a helium tank in the back.
I'd go
and blow up balloons and walk through the corridors. Here, kid, have a free balloon. Mommy, it says Mrs. Fields. I want one. And some parents would totally be oblivious, and other parents would look at me like, why did you do this to me?
Yeah.
Because I want your money. And now they have the choice of saying no to the kid and dealing with the attitude about no.
Yeah.
Or just going, fine.
Yeah, here, shut up.
Right.
Okay.
You happy?
Yeah. Getting them in the door. Once you do, I'm coming here to buy some cookie for my kid. I may as well get a cappuccino since I'm standing here. By the way, that smells pretty good. Give me one
of those. Right. If I can convince you to buy one cookie, I can upsell you.
Yeah, I can get you now. So, this is really important because, I was telling this to Starbucks regional people.
Mm-hmm.
They have a Starbucks in Singapore. the people in Singapore, they don't quite get it. They don't quite get
what it means. I didn't
think
that was a coffee-drinking country.
It's not.
They're tea.
Check it out. Check it out. These Singapore citizens want to be in the club. So now they've learned
you to assimilate America.
You can't be in the club unless you got the Starbucks with the little heat thing around it and your laptop. These are
signatures.
These are signatures that you have to have in order to be in this club. So there's a line at Starbucks and they don't know what to get. This is fine. Starbucks doesn't care. Just as long as you're coming in the door
and getting something.
Me, and you can't get something there. Okay. I'm telling this to the Starbucks people. They're saying, oh, it has something to do with coffee. I says, no, if you will look in the garbage, you'll find that only 10 or 20% of that coffee is being drunk. Most of it is being carried until it gets cold, and then they throw it away.
There's a lot of psychology around food, yeah, and it's very interesting.
This was so intense. They were thinking of opening additional Starbucks because there's like really very few of them. Land prices are so high. There's a McDonald's in Singapore, and it's almost a formal restaurant. The best and richest business people in Singapore will stand in line to go through that McDonald's. People have had their wedding receptions at the McDonald's and had to make arrangements with the manager a month in advance. It's got nothing to do with the burgers. And I keep trying to tell the Starbucks people, it's not the coffee. You are selling an idea. And the idea, like the picture of Michael Jordan, the silhouette of Michael Jordan.
The Jumpman.
Yeah. It's far more important than the gym shoe.
It's far more important than the man.
It's more important. And Michael Jordan hadn't played basketball in 25 years. Maybe longer. Oh, by the way, Ernie Banks has died. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, when I heard that David Bowie died, I said, What? What's happening?
Yes. And that same week.
Mick Jagger?
Well, the same week that Bowie died, then you had, I can't think of his name, but he was a really predominant actor, died like 2 days later. And there was all these things in the cosmos. You kind of go, what's going on?
Yeah.
But it's the psychology of food as an entire you have to be dedicated to understand that. And marketers, especially food marketers, there is a distinction between what they do and what TJ Maxx, Sears, and all the rest of them do. They're hitting on some of the same notions.
There's something in there.
But food marketing is quite different. Yeah. It's just like photography versus food photography. Standard photography of people and plants and animals are
this
way.
That's a separate division.
But to do food well, food does not actually look that good, just a snapshot of it. And you can see that with Pinterest and people's Instagram account. They go to a restaurant and they snap a picture of the food, and 60% of those pictures aren't representing that food well. Mm-mm. The lighting, the colors, this and that, it's just wrong. So food marketing has always kind of been a niche, and they had to do things like, if you're going to make a commercial of ice cream, it's not really ice cream. It's instant mashed potatoes, because it's going to melt and you're not going to get what you want from it. If they're pouring milk in a commercial, it's glue.
It's
diluted glue, because milk actually has a translucent bluish tinge to it when it's real milk. The stuff on TV is seriously white.
Yes.
And completely pourable. And look how it drips. And all that's a complete different discipline. Yeah. Even from what I do, I can make a plate look really, really good, but will it transmit the same idea of what I see in a human eye to a camera lens? There's a big difference.
Yeah, the marketers wish they knew. They believe it now to be in your limbic brain, so that it's actually hardwired. And if we can find a way to get to that, and like I say, they did research with rhesus monkeys. I don't know if you know about this, but they would set up cages of rhesus monkeys, and they would show television commercial with no sound.
Okay.
And they would have monitor to watch how long each rhesus monkey turns and looks at that television when a commercial comes on. And they would monitor how many tenths of a second this monkey attention. who's going to pay attention to it. And apparently there's some kind of switch in their head that makes them turn and say, huh, what is that? And they're using that switch. They wanted to test it on children, but the people in the ethics community, they says, you're stop. Not going to do that.
You're
doing something harmful. Because to take children and intentionally expose them to hypnotizing stuff may have some unexpected deleterious
effects. Buy Fruit Loops.
And then for some reason, the kid is watching Pokemon until he has a seizure. So we don't know that you're messing around something inside of there. And there may be some problem that the lawyers will say, oh, okay, let's settle it. Oh, you hypnotized my child. Oh, you did. And she killed herself. Oh, she did? Oh, that's not our fault, Your Honor.
America is one of the last industrialized nations to put restrictions on marketing to children. In France, you are not ever going to see a cartoon cereal commercial. Those two things are completely, no, they're verboten because they do not think it's a good idea to influence the eating habits of children based upon your cartoon animal.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't do things like we do here. They don't allow, if you go in our grocery stores, all the kiddie cereals are at a kid's eye level.
There you go.
The good cereals, the good for you cereals are on the top shelf or completely at the bottom. We have this hyper-colored section. Look, Mommy, that's Frankenberry. I want that. Look, Mommy, that's Snap, Crackle, and Pop. I want that. We're the only country that still allows them to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's slowly becoming no.
Right.
There's less of it now than when I was a kid. There's less of it now than when my kids were really young.
Yeah.
They're not doing as much. Tony the Tiger is not seen at every single commercial break. In between the cartoon Tom and Jerry,
exactly.
Okay? How it's this overabundance of stimuli.
Yeah.
And the connection with Mommy I Want, and I saw it on TV, is almost a direct link.
Yeah. I read a book about children's television in Chicago. Bozo Circus is actually a really important show, as it turns out. And it turned out that they would get endorsement from the Bozo characters for different products. But the people in charge always made sure to say, don't say, tell the kid, ask Mommy to get this for you. They absolutely refused to do that, even though the
other people
advertisers
did.
Wanted them to. But they wouldn't do it on Bozo.
They should do that with the radio programs. Like, you'd listen to Little Orphan Annie on the radio, and it was, ask Mommy for an envelope so you can mail and I will send you whatever.
Mm-hmm. But on Bozo, they refuse to do it. They says, ask Mommy to look for it.
Look for Malto Meal.
Look for it.
Okay.
No, ask Mommy to get you some. And just that small thing was enough to upset the advertisers to the point where Bozo was kind of in trouble, except Bozo could produce the numbers. But there's this book called... what's it called? Overfed, Undernourished.
Okay. Yeah.
People should check that out, because this link between fun and, you know, kid stimulation and stick something in your mouth was so closely tied that kids eat when they're not hungry. And this is what the marketers want. This is what the profiteers want. But look at the unfortunate results.
Childhood obesity.
Yeah. So,
childhood diabetes.
Yeah. What are we doing? And then, of course, bulimia and
anorexia
are tied to this notion that your head has been changed. Your head has been told continuously. Your self-image, your power over yourself, your desire to be popular, all based on sticking something in your mouth.
Well, a lot of analysts of the complexity of anorexia boil it down to one essential notion. The preteen or pubescent kid that is refusing to eat, a lot of it has to do with the psychology of control. They say that an overbearing mother, a domineering father, a society that makes you do this whole list of things, anorexia is, you can't make me eat. It is reaping a portion of control. You can choose my clothes. You can tell me what school I have to go to. You can tell me what time to wake up and what time to go to bed, but you cannot force feed me anything. So, by the way, I'm not going to eat anything as a matter of protest.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to eat what I want to. Yes. Right. And it's the psychology of control.
Yeah, to the point where I'll die.
Just to prove my point.
To prove my point, I'll die. Now, say one more thing to me.
I won't eat for another 3 days.
I won't. It's not that I hate you. It's just that I got to have some place that belongs to me.
Right.
It belongs to me somewhere.
Where's my dominion? And I think a lot of American teens feel that on various levels.
Oh.
That everything that you're doing in high school is determined by who? Outside of you. You bought the Guess jeans because all your friends had them. You ate the Pop-Tarts because all your friends said they were delicious. Right?
I don't have that kind of cell phone. Nobody has that kind of cell phone. Nobody likes you.
I'm special. And how do you determine your specialness? How do you make that happen?
How do you make that definition? How are you going to be you? Yeah. So I think the target marketers are going to try to get that. If you want to be unique, this is the kind of tattoo you should have. This is the kind of cigarette you should smoke. All that.
But yeah, that's the problem with trends and fad. Mm. That early adopters of certain things, like tattoos, were taboo forever and ever.
Absolutely.
The only people who had tattoos were outlaws and pirates.
And not because they wanted them. No, no. The court would demand that this was put on you. We still have this in our culture. When you go to court, what's the first thing you say? Raise your right hand. Because that's where they used to put the tattoo. If you say, if it had an L, it means you were a convicted liar. If it had an S, if it had a T,
the scarlet
they
letter.
No, yes.
You because, must wear.
But that's because scarlet letters on your clothes.
Yeah.
Okay. The tattoo was a way of saying, P, prisoner. S, slave. Don't tell me you're not a slave. Raise your right hand.
Mm-hmm. So you
okay,
get,
so
you
we
get
went
things.
From hating having a tattoo to embracing
artistic.
This. I think, well, then I'm going to have one. If I'm going to be a bad man and an outlaw, I'm going to be one.
If I'm a Hell's Angel, I have a tattoo.
You damn right. You ain't until you're not. In this club until you're in this club.
Right, until you get inked. Well, and I have tattoos, and I look at it this way. It's not a rejection of anything or anybody or any philosophy. Not at all. Some people do exactly that. It is foreboding for a Jewish person to
Absolutely.
Have a tattoo.
Absolutely.
It is foreboding. You will not be buried next to your family members if you do this.
That's why Hitler had insisted.
Right. So, for me, it was my body is my temple, and if I choose to decorate it the way I want to decorate it, that's my choice.
Yeah.
It's not
Judaism, it's called desecration.
Right. Some people say I've desecrated, but I say I've decorated.
Okay.
So it got nothing to do with anybody outside. It has to do with me. So early adopters of things like tattoos, like socialization things.
Oh, yeah.
The early adopters then find out that they're trendy. And then, like, in high school, we had emo kids or the overly emotional goth kind of, you know, vampire loving.
Yeah.
I'll wear the dark makeup, dark this, guys wearing eyeliner yeah. and, you know, lipstick. That mode became trendy. It got popularized when movies actually made characters that did these things.
Clockwork Orange.
And then we ended up finding out that, oh, I'm not unique because here comes 4,000 more people doing the same thing I've been doing for the last 10 years.
Yeah, I've been co-opted. I've been turned into a marketing piece.
Right. You know,
I can't get the tattoo off.
Or worse yet, you turn on a television and in a commercial, there's somebody looks just like you.
Yeah,
and you've been trying to be unique.
I've been trying to get away from that. Now they come chasing after me.
all of that is just hilarious to me. And I think food trends are just the same. I'm any kind of popularization. And so I land with you in a conversation I've had with the other two chefs that I've interviewed, the concept of celebrity chef or celebrity television, reality television. When I was a kid, all you could get as far as educational cooking related information on the television were Jack Pepin, Julia Child, and a few very dedicated individuals that would put on a show and show you step by step how to make coup à vin, how to do these different things, and opened you up visually and sometimes culturally to other worlds, French, Italian, etc. They were educators. Then you look up a few years ago, you've got the Food Network that runs 24 hours a day. You have every major broadcasting station having Rachel Ray and this one and that one. And I can name 1,000 quote unquote celebrity chefs that it did. The show eventually turned from what they know how to cook to who they are.
Yeah, there you go.
Mario Batali is liked for his personality.
Or not liked for
Bobby Flay.
Oh, Bobby.
I don't like Bobby because I think he's kind of arrogant and
gotta
a little.
Be. Well, sometimes they go, yeah, you got to be. You got to be somebody.
Right. And it's overblown. I don't like Rachel Ray's show because she's not a chef. She has a set of skills, but she was clinked on the head with a magic wand from our dear sainted Oprah and determined you're the next one, honey.
You're the next one.
And now her show is this, that, and the other. Her cookbooks, her kitchen wares, her pots and pans, her
labeling and marketing.
Her EVOO, her extra virgin olive oil, has got her face
goodness.
On it.
She's and got a picture on it, like Newman.
Like Newman.
Oh.
She has her own line of pet food.
Oh, my goodness.
She has dog and cat food now.
Oh, my doggy will only eat this kind. And so, yeah.
I'm sorry. There's not a real chef in the industry that would put out a dog food and market it as this is what I do.
Emerald dog food. It's, okay, but check it out. The one celebrity I did like, Justin Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
He was a chef, sort of, but that was not it. He was Justin, and you enjoyed sitting with this guy.
He was funny.
Even if he isn't cooking anything.
Absolutely.
You would sit there and listen to Justin tell you about this. And I'd say, well, now that's what I mean by a show. Every now and then he would cook something.
Right, right. I loved him.
I'm paying attention to you.
Right. I actually even had the pleasure of meeting him once. And it was really cool. When I worked at the Palmer House, we used to have a Cajun restaurant. We had the French Quarter. That was our premier restaurant outlet in the hotel. We had
Air on tea.
We had had a few. He actually came as a celebrity chef and did live demos in there, and he was a very cool person.
Yeah, and people aren't necessarily writing down his recipes.
Oh, absolutely not.
They're here to see him.
Well, not only
which
that.
Which is cool for me.
He was a non-formula cook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he gets to chop an onion. Oh, just throw it in there.
Yes.
Well, is it 2 cups or is it 1 cup?
Oh, you put as much as you like.
Right. And it's like, no, it's how I feel today.
People usually ask me, what kind of wine do I drink? They say, the kind I like.
Exactly.
What kind should I drink? The kind you like.
Right. And a lot of what I call a legend chef or a household chef, that one that has been taught through generations of women coming down. You're the 5th, 6th generation that you know of that have played with these recipes, great grandmama's dinner rolls.
Yeah.
There were no concrete measurements.
No.
She will put you in the kitchen
she
and
said,
say,
this is how you do it, girl.
This is right. And you get it until this point. And you
and
go, well,
she'd say, no, that's not right. And then you'd say, what did I do wrong? Well, you just didn't do it right.
Right. So it's almost intuitive. You had to play with the product. You had to know the product. You had to know how it looked, felt.
Yeah.
It way before you finished cooking.
Yep.
You had to be able to look at the cake batter and say, this is going to come up
right. How hot is the oven? Till it's hot enough.
Well, my great-grandmother worked on a wood-burning stove.
Yeah, yes.
How do you determine how hot the wood-burning stove is?
By putting your hand near it. Of course, I still use that buzz bus. So you can smell, and sometimes you can put your hand near it and say, no, that's too hot. You just got to know.
Right. So, yeah, and for a long time, even though, yes, measuring things was a part of how I learned how to cook in the beginning, a lot of the stuff that I was taught was, come here, let me show you.
Come here. Now, today we're going to do this.
And that's all it's going to be.
This is how you make cornbread. Now, you start with this. Now let me see you do it. No, no, no. Girl, don't you
do it like that. Do it. I don't do it like that.
Yours ain't going to come out right. I'm telling you now.
And
then
also,
when you like to cook, daddy could always say, who made this cornbread?
It's not right.
It ain't right.
Right. And there's so many.
Shut up. Don't say that. Your daughter made that cornbread. Now, you eat it. Oh, well, then, okay, since it's politically correct that I eat my daughter's cornbread and tell her, oh, you're a good gal, child. You're going to make a fine wife one day.
Oh, my God, yes. And I don't know if that culturally is the experience of some of our Anglo ancestors and compatriots in this society. However, it is almost completely every single Black African American that I know has stories like that.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of the cooks that taught them how to cook always had something that they couldn't do well.
That's the way that, and I think it should be that way.
This person makes amazing chili. But if you ask her to make a biscuit, you can forget it.
You got some white bread over there to put with the chili.
Because this ain't happening. And I think a lot of times with culinary colleges, there is a formula. They're very good at teaching you measurement and food cost.
Cost per million.
Parts per million. And if you are making a pot of chili, culinarily wise, as a chef, you need to know that bowl is going to cost you $1.47, and that means I can sell it at $6 a bowl, or whatever your numbers are.
You break even here.
Right. That's what culinary school teaches you. But if you didn't have the breaking in into a kitchen where you were taught that this recipe is going to work by eye, by taste, and by hand. If you didn't have a hand for pastry, you can't do it. Yes. They don't teach you that.
Yes. Jacques Pepin, he was one of the greatest guys. I never thought he could cook until one day he put a cookie sheet out. He had a pastry bag, and he popped out little mushroom cookies. And before you could count, it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And these mushroom cookies was popping out. And I says, you know what? Nobody can teach you that. You have to get that or you don't get it. And in a college, I don't care if you got a master's degree. If you don't know how to do that, nobody can teach you. That's what we mean by art. That's what we mean by the real skill. Mm-hmm. And if you don't keep them skills up, you will lose
absolutely.
Them.
I can show you, but I can't really
teach
you.
Yeah, I can show it to you. I can show you how to do little things on this cookie sheet. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Now try it. Now,
exactly.
Your turn. Now
exactly. And that was the for-profit module of colleges that is now the bubble's bursting on that. And you've got Le Cordon Bleu, Chicago closing, and all these other different things. That was my problem with the amount of tuition they were asking from some of these students. I can pay $20,000, go to a famous cooking school, and be taught the same skill that you're going to learn at the French pastry school, then you're paying $80,000 for the same thing I got for $20,000, because the reality of the matter is, in classroom structure, I can show you how to do. I can't make you good at it. And then we both graduate at the same time, and if we get the same job working for the same chef, one is going to do better than the other, and it has nothing to do with the amount of money that you spent on college.
Exactly. The colleges are also part of that marketing, are you in the club kind of mechanism. If you go to Harvard University and you end up spending $1.1 million to go there, you're not necessarily going to get a better education. But what you do get is membership
reputation.
In a club.
Exactly. So, and I didn't I did not encounter that
yes.
until I was working with a certain group of chefs, you get gender bias with chefs.
Yes, you get that.
They kind of discount you as a girl. But the biggest thing was graduation from the Culinary Institute of America.
Where did you go to school?
CIA graduates, no matter what's going on, if the executive chef graduated from CIA, the new sous chef, who's 20-some years old and doesn't know very much, he's going to be from CIA as well.
Yes. If you go to University of Chicago Law School, you're going to end up owing a whole bunch of money, sometimes $2.5 million. But they say, listen, as soon as you leave here with this degree, don't worry. You're going to be recruited around the world.
The doors are open.
And you're going to be able to pay that money back in probably a very short order. And so the schools are also, are you in the club? Are you in the club? You tell somebody that you are an accountant at KPMG, that's all you ever need to say. You can go anywhere in the world from now on. Oh, I used to work at KPMG. Bang, you're in. That's it. So that's part of the reason why the schools that had these famous graduates started to get in on it. They started to get in on it. Well, if my graduates can make $10 million a year, how come we're only charging the same as a state university?
Wow, good question.
Yeah, how come? But state universities have gotten in on it. Now, well, if you want a degree, they charge $90,000, we'll charge $91,000. It's a state university. It's tax supported. It's a reason. You told those grandparents that we were going to build this university out of tax dollars. It's not a private college. So why are we paying all this money? Oh, well, because if you don't charge a lot of money, the students won't think it's worthwhile.
That is the craziest concept, but it is definitely a psychology of
buying and selling.
Yeah, yeah.
Buying and selling psychology. And I think that's a very important part of the whole food thing. It's when you have a four-star restaurant right down the street from a four-star restaurant, why is there a line outside of that one? And why do you have empty tables? Remember Lou Mitchell's restaurant downtown?
Always.
Yeah. There was another restaurant within walking distance. That guy used to come outside and say, listen, coffee? I got coffee.
Samples?
What do you want? Waffle? I got waffle. People would I was one of them. I would stand in line. It would be raining at Lou outside. It cold. You'd be standing outside Lou Mitchell with 20 people in front of you. And the other guy would come on down and say,
the same thing with Ann Sather's. But how do you, if it's a trend, a fad, all of those things end.
Yeah.
The next fad is the hot thing.
Uh-huh. So, yes, marketing people, there are these companies now who claim that they know what the next big thing is going to be. One of them told me it was going to be gym shoes.
And they're right.
And I says, you're totally out of your mind.
Part
they said, no, you don't know. You're not a marketing person. You don't know.
But see, a lot of marketing isn't right. But I was taught that a lot of marketing isn't about what you want now. And it's not about need. It's about creating a perception of need.
Yes. And
I'm going to tell you what to buy.
Yes.
And then you're going to opt in.
Yes. And
instead of you telling me I need a new pair of gym shoes.
Yeah, yeah. So I sat across the table from these. This was in the early 70s. I sat across the table from these gym shoe people. Their only competition was Converse and PF Flyers. And the black gym shoes with the, and you could get the low tops or the white tops. And then for the females, they had those kids, which were like the white canvas kids.
No, you had to have the red ball kids, not just any kid.
Right, you had to have the red ball. And so that was their whole world. And so when they told me, no, people were going to pay over $200 for a pair of gym shoes, I said, okay, all right, this meeting is over. You'll go and believe anything you want to believe. But will monkeys fly simply because you're a marketer
and you tell them to?
Apparently the answer is yes.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, this is going on a little long, but it's been great. And I think we covered a lot. And how food isn't just food. It never really was. And it never probably will ever be just food. It's nutrition. It's culture. It's community. It's socialization. It's everything. and more. And a lot of people either get it or they don't. And a lot of people don't. A lot of people think of it as, I just need to eat. Yeah, absolutely. That's the first inkling of anybody. However, there's so much more to it. And I'm looking forward to doing some more excursions of the mind to get to the deeper essence of what food really is in other episodes. Please, if you like what you're hearing, hit the subscribe button and you'll get updates of whenever I post new and interesting topics at hand. Thanks a lot for listening. This is Chef Elena Alexander, and I will see you later.